Hi.
This is Take Charge Your Health with Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist, clinician assistant, and Carol Peterson, pharmacist.
Listen, learn, and I hope you enjoy the show. Bye.
Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience between us and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back, welcome back. I'm here today with one of my favorite co-hosts, Dr. Moshe Dekel. Welcome, Dr. Dekel.
Good morning. Good morning. Happy New Year. And a healthy New Year.
Oh, thank you. That's what we're working toward. That's where we're focused for ourselves and our patients. There was something that happened last night that I wanted to tell the audience. We were out to dinner and you started speaking, and what you were saying, I literally interrupted you. And I said, stop. This is a radio show. This is so important. We have to share it to a broader audience. And you looked at me. Oh, okay, Corrine. But I'm going to start out. There's going to be a little circuitous route that we're going to go through to get to the main topic. Stick with us, and I know you're going to enjoy, and more than that, I know you're going to learn. There's a lot to learn today. So, here we go. First of all, I wanted to start out at 480 BC.
Okay.
And that's with Hippocrates, with something that Hippocrates said, and the way he used to examine patients. He said, should one part of the body be cooler or hotter than the other, disease is present in one of those parts of the body. So what he observed at 480 BC was the fact that our bodies, when healthy, are thermically symmetrical. So our temperatures are the same in our body parts, of the same parts. So our leg on around our knee should be the same. Around our ankles should be the same. Around our breasts should be the same temperature. And they even had a way of diagnosing at 480 BC. They used to pack the body with a wet clay and they'd watch it dry on the body. And areas that dried faster, they understood were hotter than others. And then they would focus their attention on that part of the body that dried faster to try or attempt to identify the disease. And what were they talking about? They were talking about inflammation. That was their way of discovering inflammation. And then we went on, and this continued with that understanding. But in the 50s, there was a Dr. Ray Larson, and in the 50s, they discovered a way of measuring what they called thermal temperature, body temperature. And they used it during the war, during the Vietnamese War, and really made it very sophisticated. But Dr. Ray Larson began using this thermo heat coupled device to look for possible breast cancers. Fast forward to today, what we have now is what we call thermography. And now I'm going to pass it to you, Dr. Dekel, because we gave you a little, a very cursory history of this method of thinking. But what we're talking about is inflammation and identifying inflammation through temperature changes. Now, how does that apply to today? And how can we utilize that concept from 480 BC in modern medicine?
Excellent question. And I actually love your historical recount because it's absolutely correct. I recall the story very vividly and just can imagine wrapping the body with mud or clay to see which part dries first. As you said, the body has to be within symmetrical parameters of one side to the other. So back in the 50s, actually, it started in Europe. They looked at methods to actually measure body temperature. So, in fact, the original device that did the breast thermography was actually a plaque, of crystals that you actually put on the breast, kept it there for about 2 to 3 minutes.
Mm.
Those crystals change color according to temperature. So as they were touching the body parts, the breast in this case, they changed colors. And then they took a picture of that plaque, and then they interpreted the differences.
Wow.
Go back to the, I know, figure this one out. And so,
deep.
And they were able to actually see a variety of issues, even with this kind of archaic method. And today we have, infrared cameras that actually have 75,000 pixels to 100,000 pixels, which means each image has 75,000 points of temperature.
Really?
That is being converted to a visual picture. And with a computer-assisted program that you actually determine the exact temperature at exactly where you want to, for instance, nipples, the areola, or any other area of the breast, to the accuracy of 0.01 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
So,
obviously, very accurate.
Change, leap and bounds. Today, this method is accurate, and we are able to actually look at physiological changes on the breast and pick up, yes, you said, inflammation, pick up increased vascular supply to an area, increased activity like cell division that physiologically increases temperature. So we cannot see cell division. But what we can see is the byproduct of increased metabolic rate in a certain part of the breast. And when we see that, and now we say, okay, what is the risk factor for that specific breast? And then we take it from there.
So this is even what you're doing is, and let me clarify this for the audience. What we're doing is measuring minute temperature changes, and through those temperature changes, we're evaluating. We're not evaluating whether there's a tumor there. We're evaluating heat changes, which gives us an idea that there is inflammation and possible changes happening or about to happen in the breast. You know, right at first when this method was developed, a thermal image, a heat image, was shown positive for inflammation. And then they checked it and there was no tumor there. So they said, oh, this is a false reading.
Well, it's not really false reading.
Exactly.
It is an indicator that that specific area is exhibiting increased metabolic activity. Now, whether metabolic activity is, let's say, because of inflamed cyst or a brewing cancer, that's to be determined. But what we do, the best, for me to explain the best benefits of thermography is that it actually takes us, it gives us a glimpse into the future because it shows us physiological changes that precede anatomical changes. So it shows an increased risk on one breast in one area, for instance. Okay, so let's implement what I call the breast protocol, which is really about 30 different items that are designed to get the back to good health in general, but especially the breast, move those changes back to normal so we'd never, ever have to deal with actual cancerous tumor. So in my opinion, in my experience over 40 years in medicine like yours, this is one of the best ways to do prevention rather than say, oh, we have a problem. And who would not want to prevent? I mean, it's much easier than trying to deal with cancer.
I'd like to make a comparison or discuss a possible comparison. Now, we have this medical protocol of doing annual mammographies, or biannual, as they said in Canada. They don't want annual anymore. They want biannual because they feel that there is a risk to radiation to the breast. They even state the fact that with the pressure and compression, when you're dealing with one mammography, it's 1,000 times stronger than an x-ray, like if you do an x-ray of the lungs. So I want to make a comparison. What is a mammography scene, and what's the accuracy of a mammography?
Excellent question. Let's start with the last part of the question. According to my reading of the literature, mammography accuracy is 65%, which is pretty low, because that means 35% of the time you actually don't see it. Another fact of life, unfortunately, is that the majority of women find their own lump and breast cancer about 6 months after a negative mammography.
Oh, really?
So, I know, it's crazy, because it takes about 10 years to develop. And you had a negative mammography 6 months ago, and now you find a tumor, and now we say, yes, you know, we confirm it. So obviously, in my opinion, and I admit it's a minority opinion because the golden standard in medicine is still mammography. And again, I'm not advocating against it. What we are doing here, in my opinion, is actually educating our audience about what we know to be truth. And it's up to them to decide to investigate it further and to decide whether or not they want to implement it or continue to do the mammography. So to continue the answer on your great question, okay, how many false positives we're getting on mammography? What I mean by that is the following. Let me correct. It's not exactly false positives. Mammography is able to see calcification in the breast. Okay, now, the large majority of calcification bursts are totally benign, unless you see what we call microcalcifications, which are small calcification, around what we call a density on the mammography. That is a sign that needs to be investigated, okay? But what about 1.6 million women per year that have mammography? And the report says the following. We have some calcification. We don't think it's anything but. And the only word the patient hears is the but. And when a patient hears the but, they say, oh, okay, what do I need to do? Well, I mean, if you want to make sure, I mean, the only way to deal with it is really to do a biopsy. So we perform 1.6 million biopsies a year in the United States of breast. According to the literature that I've read, 80% of them are negative, which means 8 out of 10 biopsies should not be performed. So, and you can imagine the anxiety and the stress and the pain, discomfort that women go through just to hear that, yeah, this was a simple calcification. So this is something that women need to understand.
So when we're talking about mammography, we're talking at looking at a formed lesion. And that formed lesion could have begun 10 years prior to its first identification, because in the majority of women, what we're dealing with is a slow growing growth. But when we're talking about thermography, we're just looking at thermal changes. So we can identify, well, maybe there could be something going on in this area, before there's even a lesion. So there's no visible lesion there. Consequently, there's the potential of moving right in and acting as a preventative. As Dr. Frank Schallenberger always says, he says, the best way to treat a disease is not to get it. And so that's what we're looking at here. But we're also looking at, you know, thermography can be a powerful in and of itself form of following health. But it also, we're looking at a very big industry based on mammography. We're looking at, let's say, no, this isn't New York, but I've got the figures from the Midwest. $100 average mammography, which is not generally the prices in New York or New Jersey. And we're looking at 65 million women who are eligible over the age of 40. That's only over the age of 40. We're looking at a $6.5 billion per year industry. And then those who then go into biopsy at a minimum of $1,000, but we're looking at $10 billion in total between the mammography and the biopsies, $10 billion. No wonder they don't want to change. Thermography could be a door to reducing the need, not eliminating, but significantly reducing the need and becoming an adjunct to diagnosis and breast care. It's a pretty exciting method, and it's not new. It's not new. It's been around forever, and the concept and the understanding has been around since Hippocrates' time.
Right. You brought up actually an excellent point. Actually, this was studied and published in the Journal of Radiology back in 2001. What they did is they took two groups of women. One group had mammography only, and the suspicious ones were advised to have a biopsy, and they did. The other group had mammography and thermography, and they found that they were able to exclude or to reduce the amount of women that went to for a biopsy by 20 or 30%.
Wow!
So yeah, and this was published in the conventional medical journal, Journal of Radiology. You can't accuse them of being progressive or being holistic, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So that, as you said, this is not new. However, the wheels of medicine turn very slowly, especially when you take a turn, because there are studies upon studies, and you mentioned Canada, and there's this Canadian studies back in 2000 that actually showed that not only mammography is not saving lives, it actually increasing chance of getting breast cancer. There's another European study, I think a Danish study, that showed similar findings. So yeah. Even in conventional realm, I mean, they know, or they should know, the dream of mammography is not saving lives, but it's a big industry. And it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction of, okay, you need to do mammography. And there are women who innately understand and know that it's not good for their breast. And they would say to the doctor, you know what, how about I do an ultrasound? And if the doctor agrees and write a prescription for an ultrasound, they go to the radiologist. And now they're getting hassled. They say, no, you have to do mammography first.
First, yes.
And I'm sure you've heard about this.
Yes.
Complaint from your patients. And my contention is that a radiologist should not be in a position to tell the patient what to do. That's why they have a primary care or they have gynecological experts in the field that decide what they want, not what radiologists think they need to do. So again, I think the purpose of our conversation is really educational and just let the audience know what the possibilities are and what their rights are, and you can, once you investigate it and you think what's good for you is not according to what the radiologist thinks, stick to your ground.
Now, I have a question a little bit off the subject and very controversial, specifically in holistic circles. There are places in the city and probably all over the country that advertise full body thermography, and they are screening for cancer. They're not screening for an injury in the ankle, or they're screening for wrist malfunction. They're screening for cancer, total body cancer screen. What do you think of the use of thermography as a total body cancer screen?
Useless. In one word. Totally useless and false advertising. And when I get a call from a patient that tells me, you know, do you do full body thermography? I say, yes. Can I ask you a question? They say, yes. I say, what are we looking to accomplish with full body thermography? And when they tell me the story, like you just mentioned, I said, don't waste your time, don't waste your money. It doesn't pertain to looking at other parts of the body for cancer, or any other than inflammation. So, okay, so we have inflammation, right? But don't think it's cancer. Also, what we need to remember is that the only thing that thermography is really devised and is helpful is breast. We can see the thyroid, and we can do dental. In other words, we can find focuses of inflammation in teeth. Other than that, it has no scientific basis to do any kind of surveying of risk analysis of cancer in any other parts of the body. And number two, back in 1982, the FDA, yes, the FDA, actually, in their guidelines, decided or decreed that breast thermography is a good adjunct to breast screening. So this is 50 years ago, so it's not new.
They also recently, relatively recently, in the last 10 years, the case of thermography was brought before the court because insurance companies refused to pay for it, and it was brought before the court in New Jersey. And New Jersey legitimatized the use of thermography as breast screening and demanded that it be paid for by the insurance companies. But yet, that was one state. It didn't translate to the rest of the country, and it hasn't translated to the rest of the country, unfortunately.
Yes. If women's organization would would understand the story that we're telling them and would put emphasis on addressing the issue, some changes may occur. But at this point, you know, a lot of women didn't even hear about thermography, so they don't know what it can do for them and why they even have to look at it. So hopefully this conversation will kind of give them enough curiosity to say, okay, let me check it out.
When I first heard about thermography, I heard of this radical, absolutely radical, and yet conventional oncologist who would, his patients with breast cancer, he would begin to treat them with whatever agent he was treating them with chemo or radiation. And within the next 2 to 3 days after treating them, he would do a thermography on his patients because he wanted to see a reduction in circulation to that area. If there was no response that he could identify from the thermography, he'd shift his therapy. And I always was so impressed by that because of the fact that, first of all, you had an immediate reading as to effectiveness. And second of all, you had this willingness to shift the therapy until you got a positive reading in terms of circulation to the area. I was always impressed by that. And that's why I learned about thermography the first time I ever heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's definitely a novel way to look at things. I haven't read this study. I don't know if it would take just 3 days to see a temperature change, but I respect his ability and his openness to say, you know what, I can use this modality to actually get better results for my patients, so I applaud his way of thinking.
Yeah, I was impressed. Now, I would like to switch a little bit and let's talk about us as clinicians. We spot through thermography, we spot an inflammation. There's no visible lesion, but there's inflammation in the breast. There's increased circulation or whatever we change, temperature changes, whichever way that we identify it. Now, how would we go about to prevent?
That's an excellent question, in my opinion, the crux of the matter. So, as I mentioned before, we do have a breast protocol that addresses all the parameters that have influence on us developing or preventing cancer. And if you notice, I didn't say breast cancer. You say, wait,
yes.
Is it breast cancer or is it cancer? And I'm telling you, cancer, not breast cancer. And you say, well, why is that? Because we tell our patients that breast cancer is not an organ disease. The same way prostate cancer is not an organ disease. It's really a failure of the immune system to identify cancer cells within our body every day. And it goes undetected and unaddressed for long enough, years usually, then we're faced with clinical cancer. So what we need to address is everything from lifestyle to diet to digestion to hormones to detox.